I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This is episode 053, CG Excursions. The revolution will be televised, near peer and peer conflict in the 21st century. I'm recording this and releasing it a little later than normally is my custom, but I will be on travel the next 2 weeks, so I wanted to lay in this broadcast to make sure that it gets out there. So during my absence, I still yield to my fortnightly cadence of issuing podcast episodes. A little bit of housekeeping as usual. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can email me directly at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. That will be in the show notes. I have a Substack that is also in the show notes. And I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. And when I get the opportunity, 3 to 5 times a week, I blog there on military machinations, disasters, and malpractice planet-wide. You may find it amusing. You may find it shocking. Well, actually, you may find it both. Any of you who don't have your head in the sand are probably aware of what recently happened when Israel, the IDF, and probably allied nations in concert with the effort were managing to take communications devices from walkie-talkies, ICOMs, pagers, apparently cell phones, maybe even other electronic modalities, and remotely detonate those with what appears to not be battery explosions from lithium batteries, but a compromise and penetration of the supply chain that took months, if not years, to get prepared to put in some kind of plastic explosive in very small sizes like PETN or C4 to make these detonate. It has caused nearly 3,000 casualties among the Hezbollah leadership and cadres in Lebanon, Gaza, and every place in between, probably hit some people on travel. And I would also imagine there's a lot of unintended consequences of this. For instance, I would imagine that I hope they didn't know that someone was on travel in an aircraft. Someone was on travel on public transportation, maybe in a taxi cab, maybe with their family, and this detonation occurred, and what could happen with that? Who knows? We'll find out forensically in the next few months when folks start digging around in this and discovering just what happened. And that brings us to our topic today, in which we're going to discuss revolutions and military affairs. Now, I have picked at this idea and brought this idea up and suggested things that are related to it in a podcast previous, for instance, when I discussed Nagorno-Karabakh and my suggestion that what happened in the fall of 2020 between Azerbaijan and Armenia was a true revolution in military affairs for the 21st century, because what we're seeing now is a great leveling in technology, in tactics, techniques, and procedures, which would be TTP in military parlance. And we're seeing this expansion and a veritable democratization of the means to affect the exquisite platforms of larger and more sophisticated militaries. We refer to those as near-peer or peer competitors on the martial landscape around the globe. And what you discover is that with the increasing technology, the employment of new concepts of operations, and of course concepts of employment and the functional descriptions thereof, that lead folks to be able to use these in ways that we didn't consider before. I want to remind you as a preamble of several things. War is probably the leading collision in human affairs throughout human civilization and history, in which large, complex, fractured, fractious, fog-ridden, friction-ridden and Murphy-ridden armies, quite literally armies of men and or women on occasion, fight each other in alliances, one-on-one. They may be allied or axiomatic against each other. Whatever the case may be, these are the largest collisions of complex adaptive citizens that lead to these frissions and explosions of anti-fragility, unintended consequences, second and third order effects, which are usually unmapped despite the anticipation and planning gravitas and intelligence of a lot of folks who plan warfare. But nonetheless, what we discover is that rarely does the plan before bang, that would be left of bang, rarely does that plan adhere 100% to what the plans were right of bang because of the collision that occurs here on an exponential and, might I say, existential basis. So you ask, what is this revolution in military affairs? Now, I did some research and I found out that Marshal Nikolai V. Ogarkov, chief of the Soviet General Staff in the 1970s, was among those who declared that a military technical revolution, later called a revolution in military affairs, which we refer to as an RMA in the remainder of this podcast episode, as the Russians sought advanced technologies, especially what they referred to as informatics. It's interesting that the Russians, the Soviets then, would use these kind of terms because those of us steeped in the history and intelligence landscape of the Cold War are familiar with the term informatics and also other terms like the strategic calculus and calculus of forces that goes into the planning of warfare at the operational and strategic level. These informatics and precision strike weapons employed at long ranges were beginning to revolutionize the nature of warfare. Now, I have spoke to you in past episodes. As a matter of fact, I devoted an entire episode to what that looks like as far as the Russians are concerned when I talked about, in episode 48, CG excursion, peer strikes, ISR complex, that is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, the need for rational fires coordination. And I talked about the way the Russians have broken the code on tactical to operational level, metal on target, by webbing and harnessing their sensors and effectors together from the tactical to the operational. And as we are going to see in the future at the strategic level when it comes to IRBMs and ICBMs, in a fashion that is quite brilliant, and the West has not broken the code on how to do it. Now, this RMA concept was initially based on theory and not combat experience. The first opportunity to make a judgment from the evidence of a significant conflict that we'll examine in brief is the Gulf War of 1991, in which we have the U.S. forces along with coalition allies in 1991, in a very brief war, take out in detail the fourth largest army on Earth at the time in 1991, which was the Iraqi army. Now, on paper, left of bang, it looked formidable. They had been fighting the Iranians and the Iraqis. The Iranians and the Iraqis had been fighting each other in the 1980s, in which Saddam Hussein was a federal employee during that time. Of course, there was a turnaround once he invaded Kuwait and his utility to the U.S. Western political, military, economic complex came to a low ebb, and it was decided to teach Saddam Hussein a lesson in the 1991 conflict, in which it turns out the Iraqi army was bested, neutralized, and destroyed in large pockets. Throughout the 1990s, the U.S. would maintain air sanctions against them, engage in some air combat. For the most part, though, leaving the Iraqi forces to lick their wounds, tend to their reconstitution, and by 2003, as we all know, those of you who have been alive since that time and maybe reading the news or reading books about this very thing, the 1991 spanking of the Iraqis turns out to be unfinished business, which is sort of completed in 2003. But what we discover is that the United States goes in there, lasts about 8 to 9 years, 2011, 2012. The U.S. starts to draw down its Iraqi occupation, as it were, the training for all of those years of the Iraqi army, results, of course, in the Iraqi army collapsing within months against ISIS and other martial competitors inside Iraq proper as soon as the U.S. and the allies left, much like what happened in August 2021, where in Afghanistan, the U.S. and the West discovers that for two decades, all the training, the blood, sweat, and tears, and trillions in money spent there created an army, in this case, the Afghan National Army, and one that I was directly involved with, the Afghan National Army Special Operations Command, for their commandos and special forces, for whom I was a training mentor and coach in 2015 in country near the Uzbeki border. It all dissolved. For the most part, it was not a mechanism, an organization, nor a armed force of any reckoning that could find itself, absent allied support, able to fight. And history shows they are not able to fight, and the Taliban won once again. Taliban kicked out in 1996. The Taliban comes back into power in 2021, manages to best, let's count them, four U.S. presidents, and here we are. Now, Michael O'Hanlon penned a very interesting article called A Retrospective on the So-Called Revolution in Military Affairs, 2000 to 2020, that I want to quote from the foreign policy cell at the Brookings Institute. So we'll visit that in a moment, but the first thing that I want to do is this. As you know, I am a history geek, and I always go way back in the Wayback Machine to discover why things happen the way they do. For instance, I do have this curious notion that when you look at the Wehrmacht from 1805 to 1945, and what happens as far as the evolution of what is arguably one of the finest fighting formations since the Roman legions at the beginning of the millennium, we discover that there are genetic traces going back to why they are so good at what they do. For instance, I will leave it to others to examine the more socio-political aspects of this, but I would say that patient zero for Wehrmacht success from 1939 to 1945 goes all the way back to Arminius' defeat of the Romans in the year of our Lord 9 AD Anno Domini. Now, the reason I say that is because for curious reasons, they stopped the Romans cold in what was almost a centrifugal expansion of the Roman Empire and confined it to virtually stopping any further, for the most part, northern expansion of the Roman Empire in the forested, mountainous regions in which these very loosely affiliated warrior clans of the Germanics, remember, Germany wouldn't become a country until 1870, so one can call it a confederation or a loose collaboration between people who sort of shared a language and culture. But nonetheless, what you discover is that if you go back in time, you find that there were revolutions in military affairs that go way back. For instance, I would bring to your attention the stirrup. What did the stirrup provide? The stirrup provided the means, for instance, of the Mongols and their ability to have mounted archers en masse that could quite literally be missile troops that could travel at very high speeds and deliver their missile volleys, in this case, arrows and such, in masses on places where it needed to be. Could it be the front of who they are attacking, the flanks, or the rear, whatever the case may be? What you find is that with that small leather or whatever the material was that comprised that stirrup on the horse allowed them to stand in the saddle, if they had saddles, which they couldn't do before. By standing in the saddle and by having that kind of control of the horse, they could have both hands employed in lobbing weapons. It could be an arrow. It could be pilons. It could be spears. Whatever the case may be, what you find is much like when you look at the Macedonian phalanx, which was subsumed by the superior Greek hoplite phalanxes soon after, that you have these RMAs in which one thing has worked for decades or hundreds of years, and all of a sudden, as a result of innovations in either material or tactical employment, all of a sudden it obviates all the advantages and successes that came prior to it in a linear fashion. We fast forward to some other episodes. For instance, we find that chariots were used against the Romans when they invaded. For the most part, it was found in both Britain at the time and also in the incursions in the east against the Assyrians. Chariots were employed. I think you would find in some Egyptian conflicts, chariots were employed. But chariots had a lot of disadvantages that were attached to them. And eventually, there's a reason why you don't see chariots used. For the most part, after probably the 2nd to 3rd century AD, then we fast forward near the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, where we find that the crossbow had a brief time as a bright, shining weapon systems employment that was quickly overshadowed by the utility of very rapid reloading of longbows, as we saw at the Battle of Agincourt, and of course with the introduction of firearms, both smoke powder and smokeless powder, and eventually what would happen over time with the employment of firearms technology, which would lead to the rapid firing firearms. As a matter of fact, there is evidence going back to the 17th and 18th century of fully automatic weapons employed that were used maybe in small densities of troops, but nonetheless, the technology was certain there, and it was a foreshadowing of things to come when firearms started to dominate the battlefield. Hence, when it came to single combat, where you had your best soldiers and leaders and such, this goes all the way back to Achilles and Hector, but if we fast forward now, you find that firearms start to erase the distinction of those extraordinarily talented single combat leaders and soldiers, because everybody can eat a bullet. And in this case, the more rounds that are expended on the battlefield, the more that are directed either deliberately or by accident into all the personnel who are on the battlefield, leading to that fiction and fog and Murphy's Law that we are so acquainted with for those of you who study military history. So I found O'Hanlon's synopsis very interesting. I want to quote from it. Quote, "There were relatively few major surprises in the evolution of military technology in the first two decades of the 21st century. Remember, he's doing a survey here of two decades from 2000 to 2020. As such, if I were to grade my own homework or compare my prognostications from 2000 with what appears to be the reality of deployed weaponry and achievable operational concepts as we near 2020, he wrote this in 18 or 19, I would, at the risk of provoking hecklers, suggest a grade of A-. Progress was modest in most sensor technologies. It was also modest in most major weapons platforms. That is, vehicles, aircraft, ships, propulsion systems, fuels, and related foundational machinery of a deployable military. Technologies such as stealth aircraft and diesel-electric submarines with air-independent propulsion proliferated and improved, but the basic breakthroughs had already occurred and been deployed already in the 20th century. So, end of quote, the point that he's making is that this is a gradation of increased efficacy, effectiveness, and efficiency, but not one that really turns things on its head to create this entirely new RMA. He goes on, computers advanced very fast. This was a general conclusion applicable across hardware and software and in civilian technologies as well as military ones. Indeed, advances in the former were so consequential as to have many implications for military domains." End of quote. I want to stop it right there. You will find, for instance, that in Iraq, Afghanistan, and all the other places in the 21st century that America and the West found itself in, they spent an enormous amount of money, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, on things like DSIGS-A, the Distributed Common Ground System Army, and other such systems to be succeeded by Palantir, in which crates of these brilliant machines would find themselves unused in both the theaters, because what they did is they didn't figure out GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. They didn't figure out that you cannot substitute machines for critical thinking by folks who are on teams and press each other on what the intelligence is that they have. Let's take a quick meandering here, and that is this. What is information? Information is the ocean of information that we swim in, this vast complex of inputs and outputs that we have in everyday society and civilization. What is intelligence? Intelligence is those things that allow us to use that in a decision matrix to decide what we are going to do now in preparation for actions that will be taken in the future. And then there's an even smaller, tiny circle within that, which is called actionable intelligence, which is as a result of the information, as a result of the intelligence, which is a smaller instantiation thereof. One can find little nuggets in there that if you put all the parts and pieces and components together in a rational fashion, you have the ability possibly to prosecute that. Now, you could prosecute that kinetically by using it for service of night letters in Iraq and Afghanistan, kicking down doors, shooting people in the face, getting military-age males, bringing them to cages, and of course, causing all the chaos that would result from that. But that was actionable intelligence that was acted upon on a nightly, weekly, and monthly basis that was supposedly to lead to victory, but we all know what it led to instead. For instance, I would say that here we are, I'd mentioned at the beginning of this episode, we had the Israelis, apparently, IDF, Mossad, Shin Bet, whatever the case may be, probably with associated intelligence agents and also some entrepreneurial supply chain penetration capabilities, pull off this very interesting Stuxnet large operation of detonating all of these pagers and audio, possibly video devices, and making them hurt the people who were carrying them at the time. Everybody knows, looking around you, wherever you are during all your waking hours, the ubiquitous concentration and employment of cell phone devices, lesser so pagers and things like that. I happen to carry a pager and I really like them because I can receive a number and I don't have to talk to anybody. But nonetheless, we have a very sophisticated targeting there, which took a tremendous amount of supply chain penetration, identifying on a whiteboard, whether virtual or real, association matrices of who had these and who was who in the leadership matrices of these organizations. And on zero day, the day that they detonated all these things, seeing what would happen after all that time and energy was spent resourcing this enterprise. Now, I have to say, I do call this a revolution in military affairs, and I think that military historians and operations research folks and soldiers of every stripe will be examining this and digging into it forensically to determine what did they do and how did they do it right and what did they do wrong and how can this be exploited in the future. O'Hanlon goes on. Other types of weapons such as microwave weapons and high-power lasers made good progress in the laboratories but remained of very limited capability in the field. Wide-scale deployment remains a future prospect. Biological weapons, non-lethal weapons, and biological and chemical sensors probably progress slower than I had foreseen. End of quote. Two comments here. Number one, where he talks about microwave weapons and high-powered lasers, there are a lot of very high technical obstacles to overcome to make those reality because of what happens with microwave as far as emissions, saturation, and the power as it starts to winnow and decline in use. Same thing applies to lasers. And the other thing that one has to consider with directed energy weapons like those is that these are fratricidal as a feature, not a bug. Anything that's going to be up there that is flying, that happens to fly through either the laser or the microwave, whether a friendly neutral threat or a airline, is going to be impacted by the system, because it doesn't discriminate between friend or foe. And for those of you who aren't aware, the employment of biological and chemical weapons is a well-founded and doctrinal trigger for employing nuclear weapons in America and the West in time of conflict. He goes on, quote, as a result, trends of warfare that I foresaw back in 2000 were indeed largely the reality of the battlefields of the 2000s and 2010s. Even if I hardly succeeded in predicting which wars would be fought or where they would be contested, high-end precision strike warfare remained a strength of the United States and gradually became a greater strength of other countries with the resources and strong military institutions to pursue it, like China and Russia. Infantry and counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations remained very difficult. However, even for the world's best militaries, this was a function largely of unavailability of sensors that could reliably find enemy infantry fighters at distance, as well as the continued unavailability of technologies that could stymie the effectiveness of simple weapons like AK-47s and improvised explosive devices available to even the most rudimentary of militias or terrorist forces. End of quote. I have gentle disagreements with Mr. O'Hanlon in some of his prognostications here. When he talks about high-end precision strike warfare remained a strength of the United States, I am here to tell you, and I've talked to you about this in detail in previous episodes, when it comes to associating, marrying sensors and effectors across the Army, and then taking that Army in littoral combat with the Navy and the Marines, and then also integrating that with allies or coalition forces, possibly, for instance, in the NATO theater, we have not broken the code, as the Russians have, when it comes to precision strike fire reconnaissance complexes. We have tackled things like the air battle management system and JADC2 and CJADC2 and all of these other systems that are out there. And America's Army and the West by extension, NATO by necessary extension, are in a terrible way when it comes to coordinating these fires and getting metal on target in under 30 to 60 seconds. In 2008, the Russian military was in the process of quite literally rising from the ashes of the former Soviet Red Army and refashioning themselves into a 21st century foe. I think they did this in concert, in a constant coordination, mentoring, teaching, and exchanges with the Chinese, possibly even the Indians and other countries, and have literally developed a system that is second to none planet-wide when it comes to taking everything on the ground. And remember, when we use the argo, the parlance of artillery, and you hear me use that term, I am using artillery in the 21st century term, not the 20th century term, which means that artillery is going to be anything that is delivered from ground or air, could be missiles, could be dumb rounds, could be UAS munitions, it could be a drop grenade, it could be a kamikaze UAS, whatever that modality may be, when it comes to these mud to near breathing space conflicts, the Russians have broken the code on this. And I will be sure in the show notes to include my colleague Les Grau's estimable project on this when he did a 2018 assessment of the Russian strike fires reconnaissance complex, which to me is the go-to for showing how it's done. Now, with that 2018 PDF, he does that almost 3 years prior to the special military operation of the Russians invading the Ukraine. They go in there with this document, this ambition, this aspirational capability to be able to take sensors and effectors and artillery and coordinate it in a brilliant tactical and operational fashion in a very timely, near real-time, and I would say in some cases real-time fashion, to destroy what is in front of them. And they've done nothing more than improve on that functionality, despite what you see in the Western coprophile media when it comes to covering that conflict. Do your own homework, come to your own conclusions, and always doubt what I or anybody else has to say, and try to find your own confirmation within your own confirmation biases, and whatever journals, books, articles, and media you employ to get that single most accurate picture of the world that I'm always telling you about. So He also says something interesting here where he says that simple weapons like AK-47s and improvised explosive devices. What he's doing here is the common practice by the Beltway bandits and the advocacy tanks. There's no such thing as a think tank. They're all advocacy tanks for whom their mission and charter is to carve out pieces of the military-industrial political complex fiefdoms and try to find lucre for themselves, as it were. What he doesn't seem to recognize, and Mr. O'Hanlon, if I'm wrong about you, and it isn't simply a technological assessment on your part, and I'm taking you to task for something that you didn't infer, let me know. But when you look at AK-47s and IEDs and things like that, as I have said again and again, when it comes to invasion of the home turf of places in which insurgents rise up to fight off said occupations, they always have a home turf advantage that is cultural, that is socio-political, that is financial, that is clan-based, blood-based, and based on the fact that they share a common culture in which they are trying to best an invader who has occupied their country. And it isn't simply technological. They know the lay of the land. They know what works. For instance, when it came to the emplacement of IEDs, of course IEDs managed to take out literally hundreds of Bradley IFVs, infantry fighting vehicles, in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though they were used less so in Afghanistan. That was more of an MRAP countryside. The very few Abrams that were used, some of them were destroyed by these massive IEDs. What did you find always associated with these IEDs, no matter what faction or resistance organization? Because remember, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there wasn't one solitary or ubiquitous resistance organization. These were webs, families, and association matrices of dozens, if not hundreds, of different resistance organizations that, at their convenience or through relationships that they had had for years, decades, or in the case of the Middle East, hundreds of years, they just so happened to coordinate, collaborate, and work with each other to defeat the invaders. What did they always bring along? And you know this, of course, because you see the footage. They always brought around and brought with them videographers, because they always took pictures, videos, and then they would use these in information operations that are incredibly more savvy than the information operations employed by the three-letter agencies and the military organizations in the U.S. and the West in both those conflicts, and by extension, the conflicts executed by the U.S. and the West in the Horn of Africa, in Libya, in Syria, and all of these other places. Well, why did they have videographers, and why did they use these? Well, they use them for recruiting, of course, but it speaks to those three pillars of a successful insurgency that I always beat you over the head with, which is grievances, real or perceived, narrative, the story they're telling, and legitimacy. Those three components are the happy and mostly successful recipe for having a successful insurgency. Let's go back to Hanlon. Quote, looking over the 2000-2020 period, just as impressive as the continued relevance of Moore's Law in predicting improved computing speed and capacity is the growth of cyber vulnerability concerns across virtually all domains of military systems. Indeed, the concern extends to civilian systems that support military operations, such as transportation networks and electricity grids. Computer systems have been introduced somewhat carelessly into virtually all domains of military equipment and operations, with little regard for years about how an enemy might exploit the resulting opportunities for hacking. Now, I'm going to stop right there, end of quote. He brings up some really interesting points, and of course, he wrote this back in 1819, and he probably didn't have the forbearance or capability to see what the Israelis executed by taking these everyday electronics and using them in an offensive and, by all regards, very effective fashion to prosecute their current conflict when it comes to neutralizing, catastrophically removing either soldiers and or leadership structures in Hezbollah in this case. Now, what you discover, too, is that he talks about computer vulnerabilities and such. Now, everybody uses cybersecurity as the buzzword. Here's what you've got to know about governments. Governments move at the speed of glaciers when it comes to improving and responding, for the most part, especially in the 21st century, especially because of computers. The ability to exploit vulnerabilities is not helped by having very centralized organizations like the federal government or its military organizations in the United States, and by extension, military organizations in the Pacific Rim, maybe it's Japan or Korea, and or the NATO countries and such, who still can't talk to each other very effectively, but they tend to centralize things. So then, and I've mentioned General Van Riper's position in the Millennium Challenge 2002 exercise. It was a concept development exercise run by the now defunct Joint Forces Command, JIFCOM. And what you discover was that Van Riper was tasked with how do you stop the Allies from establishing a beachhead, establishing a lodgment, expanding from that lodgment, and then being able to conduct unified land operations, large combat operations. Well, so Van Riper, much to his credit, scratched his head and said, well, why don't I get them left of Bang? So he did some very curious things where it came to port of debarkations. When ships came into port, ports were attacked. A number of other things that were done were rather non-kinetic. One can make the case the Israelis may have taken a page from this, and what they were trying to do with this very unique opportunity and exploitation of pagers and communications devices were, yes, in the end, it is a kinetic problem set that was employed, but it's very unique and probably unprecedented, and this is going to ripple through the future in the RMAs we're going to discuss for the 21st century. Three-star General Paul Van Riper was praised for having created the conditions for successful spontaneity with a decision-making style that enables rapid cognition. Now, those are fancy words and terms, for he did an end run left of Bang in an unexpected fashion where the Allies, in this case, weren't expecting threats to come from that would neutralize and in some ways catastrophically crippled their ability to project power. So let's finish up with O'Hanlon. Quote, the central lesson here would appear to be that even if one can forecast progress in specific technologies, one cannot as easily foresee how military organizations will combine them and integrate them into new concepts of operation. Multi-step innovations that involve several areas of military technology as well as the performance of complex human organizations are much harder to anticipate. In a way, this is stating the obvious. More complex systems are harder to understand and therefore harder to predict. But a review of these areas of military technology provides a more granular and tangible feel for why this is so and helps caution us about where we are most able to prognosticate with some degree of accuracy in the future. End of quote. You know, I agree with all of that for the most part, but I think that, and you know I don't like to predict here, I like to forecast. I forecast that a lot more things are going to happen that are going to catch America and the Allies on the back foot when it comes to these RMAs that are emerging now in the 21st century. Now, among those RMAs is going to be robotics. Now, in this case, I'm employing the term robotics, not necessarily the ones that you would see in the science fiction movies and maybe you've read in books and such, but UASs. That would be unmanned aerial systems, unmanned ground systems, unmanned surface systems on the ocean, unmanned underwater systems in both, well, in maritime operations, could be freshwater, could be brackish, could be saltwater. Whatever the case may be, if you have these and you are able to script them in one of two fashions, number one, they are terminally maneuverable by flying by wire. In other words, they are guided by humans, or they have their own limited intelligence capacity, their brain capacity, as mechanisms in which, in terminal guidance, they fall into the hatch of a tank. Or they, like mine warfare of the 20th century, if something metal comes near them, well, that trips them, and they explode. You will find, for the most part, for instance, that when it comes to improvised exploding devices and the tens of billions of dollars spent with JAIDO, the Joint Anti-Encounter IED notion that was taken up by the West during the first 20 years of the wars in the 21st century, they weren't after a TTP. They were always trying to get some kind of technological goof or some kind of technological layup instead of seeing that there were ways you could change the way you do your business that would allow you to change this fundamentally. And let me take you back to something real quick, and then we're going to proceed forward with the bone in our teeth. I talked about the Russians. I talked about what they've done since the turn of the 21st century, where arguably the Russian armed forces as a syncretic force, as a force in war, both near peer and peer, as a force conventional and with unconventional aspects. Let's not forget the Little Green Men and the cyber operations that took place between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the fall of 2020, much of that authored by the Russians. They are well ahead of the curve when it comes to all of this. The U.S. and its allies, not so much. So I'm going to make a startling suggestion for those of you who haven't heard it, but if you're a perennial listener of mine, you will probably have heard it, and that is the Russians didn't come to this in the 21st century out of the blue in a vacuum, because when you look at Russian military performance operationally and strategically from 1943 to 1945, I have said again and again, you will rarely find an organizational learning challenge and success on turning on a dime, quite literally, and being able to exploit new ways of conducting warfare as a result of both technology and employment to best what was arguably at the time the German Wehrmacht, the best of breed in military forces man for man on the planet at the time between 1939 and 1945. But nonetheless, as you guys have heard me say, and I thank David Stahel for this because he's the one who clued me into it, that famous Wehrmacht that you saw fighting from the summer of 41 to its defeat in May of 1945, mostly due to the Russians, died on the Russian hinterlands in the summer of 41 and was a zombie force that took almost 4 years to perish. But nonetheless, there's a lot of lessons to be learned from what both the Germans and the Russians did. So I'm saying that because all of these extraordinary Russian military accomplishments that those with eyes and not lies can see, you will note that none of this happened in a vacuum to the Russians. None of this has happened in a lot of these military organizations that aren't American, that Americans or the Allies tend to be surprised at when it comes to their innovation and such. So what are some of these other 21st century instantiations of RMAs that I would bring to your attention? We've talked about robotics. Autonomous targeting is big. Autonomous targeting has to happen. Autonomous targeting has to happen as a result of yet another RMA. And that RMA would be the hypersonic Mach 5 or greater speed delivery of missiles and artillery munitions. Remember, 21st century argo in the use of the word artillery. What that means is that hypersonics give a tremendous advantage, especially if they have terminal maneuvering, terminal guidance. It's almost impossible to intercept them. And mind you, we're bouncing around a bit in history, but I want to bring this to your attention. Torpedo bombers in 1942 employed against the Japanese fleet, in this case, arguably Midway, had a terrible time because of bad torpedo technology in the United States. Nothing can come close to the best of breed long lance torpedo that the Japanese employed. But when it came to dive bombers, we had two distinct advantages. Number one, the technology, the piloting and such was probably best of breed for the Americans when it came to dive bombing. Number two, and more importantly, when it comes to the interception of incoming rounds, and when you're talking about a 1,000 or 2,000 pound bomb, that's a rather large incoming round. As much as one can think as a casual observer, non-military observer, or somebody who has never been on deck with Bofors or Oerlikon 20mm and 40mm and other kinds of naval flak cannons and ammunition delivery systems, much like the R2-D2 phalanxes that you see on current surface naval systems throughout the Western militaries. You can send up all the rounds that you want. Let's just suppose that bomb is released, 1,000 pounds, 2,000 pounds, whatever the case may be. It is going into the deck of the carrier in this case in the Battle of Midway, and you happen to hit it with munitions. What's going to happen? Well, it is not terminally guided. It's not jinking and jiving. It's coming straight down, and most likely those rounds will not affect the terminal velocity of that. Now, fast forward 3/4 of a century to today, and not only are you delivering possibly 1,000, 2,000, 3,000-pound munitions, but those munitions just so happen to have fin mixing and maneuverability in terminus, which means that on their way to their target, they're maneuvering at the end of their lifespan, as it were. How do you stop that when it's traveling Mach 5? Well, we don't know. If you've kept up with the blog postings that I make at the Libertarian Institute, where for 3 to 5 times a week I take on the wharf and wolf of military mishaps in the West, serving as a warning to get our heads out of our keisters, you will discover that America, when it comes to hypersonics, and I suspect, remember, this is all unclassified, I don't know what the black funds are that have been employed in this, when it comes to hypervelocity munitions, whether offensive munitions or defending against said munitions, that capability is still moribund in the United States, and they haven't cracked the code on it. Apparently, and I could be wrong on this, the Russians have cracked the code on offensive hypervelocity munitions. America has spent tens of billions of dollars on 2 separate programs that have failed demonstrably. Now, when it comes to this new leg of munitions in the 21st century as an RMA, when we're talking about hypervelocity munitions, we're talking about defense and offense. But let's suppose that we take ourselves on a grand history tour and we realize that IRBMs and ICBMs, to include the ICBMs that have been developed since the 1950s, have terminal speeds that well exceed hypervelocity. So this problem set has been here since an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile, or an IRBM, an intermediate range ballistic missile, reaches near space, opens the top, and then releases all of its multiple independent reentry vehicles, and all of those come down at an extraordinarily high speed. So this whole hypervelocity thing, it's not new. This technology's been around for a long time. The difficulties are twofold. Number one, how do you defend against them? And number two, how do you use them yourself by employing hypervelocity munitions and on the exquisite platforms one has in the West? Well, the West hasn't cracked the code, but the Russians have cracked the code when it comes to this. Now, everybody still has a lot of work to do. For instance, I would suggest that the Russians, the Chinese, there is no near-peer or peer military on Earth that has developed a good way to defend against hypervelocity terminal maneuvering munitions that are inbound to where they live. Now, you've heard me talk in the past that when it comes to salvo competition, which is who's got the most artillery, munitions, and missiles to send aloft that land on or near other military assets, whether those are exquisite platforms or, in the case of UASs, single infantrymen in the Ukraine or Russia, what you discover is that all of that is here to stay. None of this is going to change, and something has to be done to service these targets. Servicing these targets not only in sending them aloft, but defending against them. I don't think we're anywhere near a point where the U.S. and its allies in the West have the capability or capacity to intercept these. For instance, if we look at the most formidable, by numbers, by the numbers, formidable nuclear-armed adversary and country on Earth, that would be Russia. Let's suppose that Russia was able to send aloft, and those who have listened to my podcast before know how doubtful and pessimistic I am that these thousands of rockets or nuclear bombs in inventory, who knows how many of those work, because there's arthritic, sclerotic, and problematic mechanical problems in all of these systems planet-wide. But when it comes to those, if one were to get in a nuclear exchange, the gods willing, this doesn't happen, and that nuclear exchange occurs, well, how are those missiles going to be intercepted? Well, in this case, the United States has spent billions of dollars on a system that gives you 44 interceptors. It's called the Ground-Based Mid-Course Defense, GMD, as of 2018. There's new data out there, I suppose. The system is composed of two interceptor staging bases in the states of Alaska and California, with 40 staged in the former, 4 staged in the latter, for a total of 44 interceptors, as well as the component early warning and targeting sensors that are based out there. The cost so far, by the way, this is 2020, not 2024, is $53 billion for 44 interceptors. So, those of you in the business, those of you who may have friends, family, or relatives who happen to know a thing or two about these, there's something called probability of kill. There's something called shoot, shoot, look, and shoot, look, shoot. All that means is that if I send one missile aloft against a missile that is incoming, what is my probability of kill of that? For the most part, that probability of kill is going to be bad, because if you shot one defense missile against an incoming ICBM, your chances of shooting it down are approximately 53%. You have to use 4 defense missiles, and it's 97%. So what this means is that when you look at the GMD with 44, and by the way, the success rate of 55% in highly scripted tests includes 3 misses in the last 6 tries. When you combine that with the probability of kill that I just talked about, and then you combine it with the paucity of numbers, in this case 44. This is on my blog, by the way, at the Libertarian Institute. There's more data there. September 14th, 2024, where I talk about indefensible homeland defense is not available at this time. What it means is that the Department of Defense has done, for the most part, what really comes to a little greater than zero in stopping the impact of these weapons on U.S. soil. So I've talked to you about these technologies. I've talked to you about these employments. I've talked to you about what's going to happen in the 21st century. So I'm characterizing the 21st century warfare as one of robotics, hypervelocity munitions, whether defense or offense, targeting autonomy, which means taking humans out of the loop. And a lot of people object to that. They'll see, let's say, the Terminator series and Skynet is live and those kind of things. Here's what happens when you have incoming hypervelocity munitions. Remember, that exceeds Mach 5. And remember, when it comes to IRBMs and ICBMs, once they have merged at apogee in near space and they're on their way down, I think that they can travel at speeds in excess of Mach 15 to 20. So how do you intercept that, especially if, and I keep telling you this, if it has terminal maneuvering capability? The problem is we don't have the capability to do that. So you think to yourself, they've spent $53 billion for this. The Defense Department gets nearly, when you put the DOE in the equation, nearly $1 trillion a year to spend, and they can't seem to spend it directed on defeating the employment of nuclear weapons. Well, what if these ICBMs and IRBMs happen to be not nuclear employments, but conventional employments? Well, when that thing lands, wherever it may be, because of kinetic impact and stopping, all of a sudden, like, and it's got a considerable payload on it, it will be, in a, even though it's conventional, it will be a nuclear blast type with no radiation because of what happens to kinetic energy when it is stopped so quickly. Now, Anthony Cordesman in 2014 wrote this article entitled The Real Revolution in Military Affairs. And I wanted to quote some paragraphs from his because I think he does a really good job here summing some of this up. He says, quote, "Nevertheless, the United States needs to do a better job of coping with the real revolution in military affairs. As Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam before them have shown, the United States cannot rely on professional forces and superior technology alone to fight conventional wars any more than it can rely on soft power and partnerships with weak and internally divided allies as a substitute for the use of force. The United States must adapt its forces to fight as asymmetric levels of politico-military warfare. It must progressively improve its ability to selectively attack enemy with minimal civilian casualties and collateral damage. It must do a far better job of integrating its civil and military approaches to warfare, and it must focus far more on shaping the lasting strategic outcome of a conflict than on winning tactical victories." End of quote. And then he goes on, finally, quote, "The United States needs to learn how to make choices between risky and uncertain options rather than leap in or stand and wait. It must be prepared to actually engage in terms of local realities and the real-world capabilities of its allies and local partners rather than its own desires." End of quote. So I am a fan of Colonel John Boyd. I am a fan of his definition of what strategy is. And it's so simple. There are so many people out there who are hired to make strategy, grand strategy, especially the martial variety, into something that is so bloody complex, you just scratch your head and say, well, how could that ever happen? But for me, Boyd distilled it into a very easy axiom, and that would be this. You cooperate with your allies, and you isolate your antagonists. Now, of course, a lot of this means employment, de-escalation, different means of doing one's business, having more defensive postures and such. And a lot of this also speaks to other things. When you look at Thomas Kuhn's groundbreaking 1962 book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, I happen to have the third edition near my desk, what he speaks to, and I recommend everybody read the book if you get the opportunity, is that when it comes to revolutions and scientific affairs, not military affairs, but scientific affairs, it is the old guard, it is the gray hairs, the gray beards that need to be bested, and they need to be forced to accept that the new paradigmatic shifts in thinking as a result of thinking outside the box, thinking prismatically, or new evidence arrives that tosses through a proper and rational collaborative scientific method, the paradigms of the past become just that, the past, and are reshaped theoretically and in frameworks that increase the explanatory framework so that one can move on to engineering effectiveness, efficiency, and a better understanding of the way things work. As I have said in prior podcast episodes, the U.S. and Western fixation with exquisite platforms, everything from the latest fighter jet to the manned tank to the aircraft carrier, and even more so to missiles and such, you need to rethink, you need to retool, and you need to reconsider. So my charter and my ask for my audience and those whom this episode may reach is, you really need to dispense with the old thinking. You really need to embrace the fact that in the 21st century, despite your superpower hubris, despite the thinking that, well, technology will see a way out of this, then why is it that the U.S. since 1945 has had a flawless track record of stalemate and defeat in all of its military enterprises? And yes, parenthetically, folks will say, but we won the 1991 Gulf War. Well, if we won, why did we go back in 2003? Well, there's a variety of reasons for that, because root causes and proximate causes are part of the epistemological tree that tells us why cause and effect happened in the first place. So if I leave my listeners with one thing from this discussion, is that, number one, I have not elucidated all the RMAs that are emerging, and let's say my grandson, great-grandson, great-great-grandson, if they happen to be like Sun Pin, to who was a grandson of Sun Tzu, happens to have a better vantage point to look back and say what succeeded and what didn't, I am certain that the RMAs that I talked about during this podcast episode will be superseded or added to from others that emerge that I have no idea between now and 2090. It's going to be very interesting to see what that looks like. But nonetheless, we have to red team. We have to be contrarians. We have to have the 10th man in the room to examine these. The Pentagon and all the Western military complex intellectual centers in the West have to stop and reconsider and ask themselves, if you have this sterling record of defeat since 1945, record of defeat and stalemate, what's the reason for that? Why can't we wrap our heads around that exquisite platforms and improved technology are not the be-all and end-all of defeat of military enemies in the future? So with that, I'd like you to consider it. Take a look at my show notes. I will provide you with plenty of food for thought and resources that far outstrip what I can deliver in a one-hour podcast episode. I encourage all of you to reach out to me with recommendations and gentlemanly critiques of things that I may have overlooked or got wrong. You can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You can go to my Substack. And remember, I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. I blog on a weekly basis. And with that, thanks for listening. This is Bill, out.